This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
All that said, I think we can start with some introductions. So like I mentioned, my name is Aparna Gopalan, she, her pronouns. I'm news editor at the magazine Jewish Currents. I am also a graduate student, and as such, I'm a member of the UAW, and I'm part of UAW Labor for Palestine, which is a coalition that's working inside the UAW to get the union to divest and have a better foreign policy positions. And I'm so delighted to be in conversation with Jeff Shirky. An introduction for Jeff. Jeff is a labor historian, journalist, and assistant professor at the Harry Van Arsdale Jr. School of Labor Studies at SUNY Empire in New York City. Jeff is a regular contributor at In These Times, Jacobin, and Jewish Currents, and he is, most importantly for us here, the author of Blue Collar Empire, The Untold Story of U.S. Labor's Global Anti-Communist Crusade, which is available in the conference book room and is the book that we're going to be talking about, and I'm very excited to share with everyone. The format for this session is going to be similar to what you've seen at other sessions, presumably, which is that we will have a Q&A, a conversation from the front of the room for around half the session, and then we'll turn it to you. We have this mic here for Q&A, and people can come up and you're welcome to ask questions to Jeff. You're also welcome to make comments that are, you know, a discussion comment for the entire room. But please be respectful of a 2 to 3 minute time limit so we can have as many comments as possible. Great. Sorry for a lot of talking, but all that being said, we can finally turn to Jeff and get into this book. So I guess to start with, Jeff, this book is about the AFL-CIO and its activities throughout the 20th century. Today, when I, as someone in the labor movement, think of the AFL-CIO, it doesn't resonate or mean that much to me. The power of that organization is very different today compared to in the 20th century, in the period you're talking about. And that also goes for the labor movement, which has been undergoing a decline for many decades now. So to take us back to the moment that this book is addressing, which is the early and mid-20th century specifically, can you help us understand what was the AFL-CIO at that point? What was the labor movement? What was kind of the promise of the labor movement? And why did it not fulfill that promise and go in a completely different direction? And that's a massive question, so go where you will with that.
Okay. Everyone can hear me okay? Yeah. So good morning. And first of all, I want to say thank you to Haymarket and all the organizers of this amazing conference, and thank you to Verso, obviously, for publishing my book and making this session happen, and thank you, Aparna, for moderating this, and thank all of you for being here, for your interest in the book, and for all the really crucial, important organizing and agitating and educating that you're doing in your own unions and workplaces and communities. So the question was about the power of the labor movement, the AFL-CIO, in the 20th century, particularly, I think, mid-20th century. So I'll frame my answer this way by thinking about in the present. Imagine if right now, in the year 2024, imagine if we had 35% union density. That would be about 42 million additional unionized workers than we actually have. And imagine if companies like Amazon and Walmart and McDonald's and others were wall-to-wall unionized, every worker in those companies working under collective bargaining agreements and big industrial unions. Imagine the power that the labor movement could have if that was the reality right now. Imagine how the labor movement could be working to dramatically change the political, social, and economic structures of this country and how that would reverberate around the world. So that's obviously not the reality, right? Union density is more like 10%, and the biggest companies, the biggest private employers in the country are still pretty much entirely non-union. But in the mid-20th century and right after World War II, that it actually was the reality. There was 35% union density. The biggest industrial corporations in the country, like U.S. Steel and General Motors, General Electric, were wall-to-wall unionized. One in every three non-agricultural workers was a union member. And so unions, the labor movement, had incredible economic and political strength compared to right now and compared to any other time in U.S. history. What did the labor movement, and in particular the main labor federations, the AFL and CIO, which then merged in 1955 to become the AFL-CIO, what did they do with that fleeting power? Did they organize the unorganized? Did they organize the South? Did they achieve single-payer health care? Did they hinder U.S. militarism and imperialism abroad? You know, we know the answer is no, that's not really what happened. And that's what this book is really about. And a big reason why has to do with the Cold War. A major reason for why union density grew so dramatically to 35%, the highest it's ever been, that happened within a 10-year time span, more or less, between about 1935 and 1945. But a big reason for that growth was the CIO, which was a breakaway from the AFL, more progressive and more focused on industrial organizing, organizing workers regardless of their skill level or race, gender, or where they were in the economy. And a big reason for the CIO's success, a major factor in that, was the fact that the CIO had the presence and leadership of many leftist trade unionists, particularly members of the Communist Party USA and their allies, who were dedicated, effective organizers, and who had this kind of broad social vision, anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-imperial kind of vision. So if anyone was going to, anyone in the labor movement was going to use that power to really try to remake society, it would have been those leftist, communist, union members and union leaders within the CIO. And the Cold War came about in the late 40s, and McCarthyism, the Red Scare, which was not just an accident, it was manufactured by corporate America and Wall Street for the purpose of taking out those leftist trade unionists and hampering the potential power of the labor movement, particularly the CIO at that point. A lot of the, this is why in 1947 Republicans in Congress were able to pass the Taft-Hartley Act, which placed a lot of new legal restrictions on unions and what they could do, and required union officials to sign, legal affidavits swearing that they were not members of the Communist Party and so on. And so it was really all contrived to try to drive out the left from the labor movement, again, particularly the CIO. And the CIO's non-communist leaders had to sort of make a political calculation. They could either resist this Red Scare, resist McCarthyism, or they could just decide to go along with it. And they decided to go along with it, and famously or infamously, the CIO purged the communist-led and leftist-led unions between 1949 and 1950. And the CIO, part of why the CIO had grown so powerful in the first place was because it adopted this class struggle unionism that, as Joe Burns calls it, challenging the power of management day to day in the workplace. And with this sort of calculation that the CIO eventually made to go along with the Cold War, that approach was largely abandoned in favor of a more sort of class collaborationist or industrial pluralist, like this idea we can negotiate rationally with the employers and we're all on the same side here, we all want America to succeed and that kind of thing. And trying to demonstrate the CIO's patriotism and loyalty to the United States by showing how anti-communist they were and how much they were in favor of U.S. foreign policy. So that's a big part of why this moment of great potential for the labor movement didn't really materialize is because the Cold War got in the way.
Thank you for sketching out that really important history. And one of the things that your book adds to that is to show that, you know, not only were U.S. labor leaders part of waging the Cold War, they, in the kind of early years, were actually outflanking the U.S. government from the right on the Cold War. They were kind of the first people to wage the Cold War in some senses. And that I found particularly remarkable. And you catalog that specifically through the Free Trade Union Committee, which was established by the AFL-CIO to kind of carry out an anti-communist crusade around the world, and which actually the U.S. foreign policy establishment catches up with after the end of World War II. So can you talk a little bit about the history of the Free Trade Union Committee? What is free trade unionism and what that committee was doing, and then how that kind of trailblazes the Cold War in the U.S.?
Yeah, so my last answer, I was focusing a lot on the CIO because the CIO was the more progressive union federation, more welcoming and tolerant of the left. Well, the AFL, this answer has a lot more to do with the AFL, which was traditionally much more conservative and vehemently anti-communist. And within the CIO, there was this willingness to, you know, tolerate the left and tolerate communists, and that was similar at the international stage as well, coming out of World War II, the international labor stage, we could say, in the same way that, well, I should back up and say, you know, the Cold War did not immediately begin upon Japan's surrender in 1945, right? It took a couple of years before the Cold War really kind of officially began with, you know, in 1947 with the Truman Doctrine, President Harry Truman announcing that U.S. foreign policy's main objective would be to, you know, contain communism. Also, 1947 was when the National Security Act was passed, which, among other things, established the CIA to, you know, wage the Cold War abroad. So there were a couple of years, at least, before the Cold War really got started. And there was even though there was a latent distrust between the U.S. and Soviet Union, they had forged this wartime anti-fascist alliance, and there were people, Franklin Roosevelt, before he died, had hoped that that kind of alliance, that international cooperation could continue, and some of the people in his administration and Eleanor Roosevelt also hoped that this sort of alliance between the U.S. and Soviet Union could continue. And we see that with the creation of the United Nations in 1945, which included both the U.S. and Soviet Union as permanent members of the Security Council. And on the labor stage, there was an attempt to create a kind of United Nations of Labor, the World Federation of Trade Unions, which was also established in 1945. I'm talking way too much. That was also established in 1945 to bring together both, you know, communist and non-communist union federations that all shared a common anti-fascism. And the CIO joined the World Federation of Trade Unions on behalf of the United States, but the AFL refused to have anything to do with the World Federation of Trade Unions, boycotted and vowed to divide it. So that would be like the equivalent of if the U.S. refused to join the United Nations because it included the Soviet Union, and the U.S. said, we're not going to be part of the U.N., we're going to form our own alternative U.N. that's strictly anti-communist. And what the AFL called this sort of anti-communist brand of unionism that they were trying to promote, they called it free trade unionism, this idea that, you know, we're supporting free, democratic, independent kind of unionism. But when you look at the actual history of it, which is what I did in the book, it's not really about freedom at all. It's just about anti-communism and support and bolstering capitalism at the end of the day and bolstering U.S. imperial power. So as early as 1944, the AFL was already getting ready for the post-war period where they were going to try to undermine communist influence in the international labor movement. And so the AFL created this new international arm in late 1944 called the Free Trade Union Committee. And there's a lot I could say about it, but it's in the book and I don't want to go, you know, ramble on too long. But what the Free Trade Union Committee did early on was they sent AFL representatives to Western Europe as the war, World War II came to an end. In countries like France and Italy, communists were very powerful in those countries' labor movements because they had been at the center of the anti-fascist resistance. They were very popular among the working classes of those countries. And AFL representatives through the Free Trade Union Committee went to like France and Italy and other countries to try to provoke splits in those countries' labor federations, to sort of whisper in the ears of the non-communist union leaders to say, why are you working with these evil totalitarian commies? You should break away from them and form these alternative rival splinter union factions. And the AFL was doing this on its own. That's the important point, because people often assume, oh, they were just instruments of the CIA. And that would eventually happen, but at this point, the CIA didn't even exist yet. And the U.S., you know, had not yet fully embraced the Cold War. This was before 1947. And so that's, I think, what you were sort of getting at, Aparna. And then by the time the U.S. government kind of caught up with the AFL on waging the Cold War, and the CIA was created, the CIA took a look at what the Free Trade Union Committee had been doing in splitting labor movements overseas and said, this is great work. We want to work with you. And so they formed this covert partnership where the Free Trade Union Committee now started to be funded directly by the CIA and expanded beyond only Western Europe into Latin America and Asia and elsewhere around the world. And throughout the 1950s was doing this kind of work of, again, dividing labor movements along Cold War battle lines. And so it wasn't about workers versus capital. It was about, you know, democracy versus communism, or, you know, supporting the U.S. versus supporting the Soviet Union. The labor movement became very much international labor movement. And the World Federation of Trade Unions was divided and split. I'll leave the answer there.
Thank you. You mentioned Latin America and Asia, and in the book you talk about Africa as well. And one of the really important interventions of this book is that it really looks at the Cold War not just as an East-West conflict, but as really a North-South one fundamentally, and as a way that U.S. labor leaders intervened in decolonizing countries and kind of crushed revolutionary movements in those countries alongside the U.S. government. So now we enter the kind of period of explicit, or I guess covert but explicit collaboration between the CIA and the AFL and labor leaders in the U.S., and much of that plays out in the Global South. So I'm curious about if you can talk a little bit about the strategies that U.S. labor used in the Global South to kind of silence labor movements there, which ranged from everything from supporting military coups to having an institute that is specifically about re-educating workers in these Global South countries to make them anti-communist, to funding development projects. I mean, the range of tactics and strategies is remarkable and actually extremely versatile in the way that we would want labor to function, but it's all being used for this horrible end, which is to prop up these reactionary governments around the world. So, would love to hear more about that.
Yeah, so, and this kind of moves into like a sort of later period. So the book, I should say, covers the period of roughly 1945 to 1995. And so the book is kind of broken up into three sections of like the early Cold War period in the late 40s and 50s, and then the sort of middle period of the 60s and early 70s, and then the later period of the 70s, 80s into the early 90s. So this, you know, going into the 50s and 60s, you had the rise of the Third World Movement of, you know, post-colonial countries in Africa and Asia asserting their geopolitical independence and, you know, not wanting to just be puppets in the Cold War. And this was, you know, for anti-communists in the U.S. government, this was completely unacceptable. Like, you had to be a puppet of the U.S. government or else you were the enemy. And then in 1959, with the Cuban Revolution, anti-communists in the U.S., including in the AFL-CIO, became very interested in Latin America and making sure that there wouldn't be any other Cuban revolutions in Latin America. And so to this end, between 1960-61, the AFL-CIO created another new international arm called the American Institute for Free Labor Development, or AFLD, which was specifically focused on Latin America and the Caribbean, and was funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development, which had been created by the Kennedy administration. It was sort of a descendant of the Marshall Plan. And this idea of development became an important ideological and economic tool for anti-communism and waging the Cold War, with the idea to post-colonial countries of the Global South, to say, you know, we will give you economic assistance as long as your government is strongly anti-communist and pro-U.S. And so the AFLD that was created by the AFL-CIO was sort of part of this, but focused on labor movements specifically in Latin America. And yeah, ostensibly it was like a training center where they would do training programs, like labor education classes, you know, it's kind of stuff I teach in labor studies, collective bargaining and stuff like that, to Latin American trade unionists. That was ostensibly what it was, but it was also, these classes were training Latin American workers how to resist any kind of leftist influence in their unions. And I should just say that, and even I use the word anti-communist a lot, and that didn't simply mean opposition to actual communism, it meant opposition to any and all left-wing or anti-capitalist political movements, worker-led movements around the world. So just as an example, in these classes that AFLD did, these training classes, they would do role plays where they would sort of say, you know, just like when you're training people to be organizers, you do role plays. But these role plays, I'll read, this is an excerpt from a Reader's Digest article in 1966, where this writer from the Reader's Digest sat in on one of these AFLD classes. And he said, another session rehearsed a meeting of auto workers wherein red infiltrators were trying to divert matters to political ends. And quote, you are a puppet of Yankee imperialists trained in Washington, shouted planted hecklers at Juan, the Argentine chairman. And then Juan shoots back, American workers are the highest paid in the world under the free enterprise system of class cooperation. What did you communists learn in Cuba? How to reduce living standards? How to destroy free unions? Is that how you plan to emancipate the working class? Take your doctrines back to Moscow, or is it Peking you're taking orders from this week? So this is, I mean, we laugh, but this is what they were really doing. And in addition to these sort of training programs, they would then send the graduates of these programs back to their home countries with generous funding from the U.S. to carry on their anti-communist organizing activities within their own unions. And the AFLD had a social projects department where they would carry out these sort of small-scale community development programs, setting up health clinics and community centers, and especially affordable worker housing projects, again, funded largely by the U.S. Agency for International Development, with the idea that if you belong to an anti-communist trade union, if you were a worker, rank-and-file worker, belonging to one of these anti-communist pro-U.S. unions, you could get these material benefits through AFLD. You could get affordable housing and access to healthcare and stuff like that as a way to sort of, you know, in this battle for hearts and minds. But AFLD was also involved in various military coups and other efforts to undermine progressive democratic leftist governments across Latin America and the Caribbean. One example that's not so well known was in Guyana in South America, which in the early 60s was still a colony of Britain called British Guyana. And it was going through a period of planned transition to independence. And the chief minister of Guyana was a Marxist named Chetty Jagan, who hoped to see the country through its, you know, transition to independence, promote socialist reforms like nationalizing the sugar industry, et cetera. The Kennedy administration viewed him as another Castro, and he had to be stopped. He had to be taken out of power before British Guyana became independent. So Kennedy actually like lobbied the British government to delay independence in Guyana. And in the meantime, AFLD was training some of the unions that were aligned with Chetty Jagan's political opposition. And in the early 60s, they staged this huge general strike. This is a tiny country with a small economy, but there was this huge general strike that lasted for, I believe, like 2 or 3 months. That was all meant to, you know, usually we think on the left, general strikes are good, you know, and they generally are. But in this case, the whole point of the general strike was to undermine Jagan's government and to, wreak havoc with the economy. And the strike was, the reason the strike could continue for so long is because the strikers were getting paid by, there's multiple layers of bureaucracy, but it was AFSCME, which was getting the money from the CIA. And this served to undermine Jagan's government. Eventually, he was not long after voted out of power, and then the transition to independence could move forward. Similarly, you jump ahead in time 10 years, you know, Chile, this is a more well-known example, right, with Salvador Allende's socialist government, and the working class, the trade unions of Chile were very loyal to Allende, but there were these middle class professional associations called gremios that were very much opposed to Allende. This included like engineers in the copper mines and like truckers and shopkeepers and those kinds of things. And they received a lot of funding and support from AFIELD as well, again, with money coming from the State Department, from USAID and the CIA. And they also staged these really crippling strikes in the early 70s in Chile that served as a pretext for the military coup there. Brazil in 1964, similar kinds of dynamics, lots of things. It's all in the book, so I won't ramble on. But yeah, multiple different types of tactics. And in beyond Latin America as well, I mean, most importantly in Vietnam, where the AFL-CIO's top leaders were some of the loudest supporters of the war. Even as the public in the U.S. became increasingly turned against the war, people like George Meany, the president of the AFL-CIO, remained staunchly in favor of the war. But it wasn't just like politically talking like we support the war. AFL-CIO was also active on the ground in South Vietnam, supporting the Vietnamese Confederation of Labor, which was the anti-communist union federation there, trying to undermine communists and leftists among the working class and among peasants in South Vietnam. So yes, there were a lot of strategies, education, development, supporting coups, supporting wars, and this went on for several decades between like the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Thank you for kind of talking about the diversity of places and tactics. I really want to emphasize for everyone, by the way, that we are scraping like the tip of the iceberg with this book. Buy this book, read this book. There is so much going on in so many places around the world. We're not going to be able to get to all of it, but that was a really awesome overview. I think one thing that you emphasize throughout the book, and especially we get when we get to the Vietnam War, is that the rank and file members of US unions did not know that this was happening, by and large. This was all happening right at the very top. The money was kind of, CIA money was being taken and US aid money was being taken and passed along in all these different ways without the knowledge of the base. And that starts to change in the period of the Vietnam War when there's these exposés that are published and when there's this popular unrest about the war and to try to get the US out. That changes how the AFL-CIO operates abroad, but it doesn't always change it in good ways. You talk about how the partnership between the U.S. foreign policy apparatus and the AFL-CIO goes from being covert to actually being overt and being, you know, in the period after the Vietnam War. And I'm wondering if you can play out a little bit what happened with the Vietnam War. What was the rank and file reaction to these revelations? What were the kind of ways that the AFL-CIO sought to manage that dissent, and then how did they actually proceed in the decades to come? Sorry, these questions are like, you can see, covering like 20 years each, because that's how much is going on here, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the Vietnam War, and particularly the anti-war movement here in the U.S., was a really important turning point in the Cold War, where, you know, large swaths, maybe even the majority of the U.S. public, started to understand that, you know, this crusade against communism was actually hugely violent and repressive, reactionary form of imperialism. And the fact that, as I mentioned, the AFL-CIO was so vocally supportive of the war got a lot of people, including rank-and-file union members and journalists and elected officials, more interested in what the AFL-CIO, you know, they were like, why is the AFL-CIO talking about so much about Vietnam? And they started looking into all these activities that I've been talking about that had been already been going on for several years. And it started to come to light for the first time, because prior to the late 60s, most rank-and-file union members and workers didn't really know that any of this stuff was going on, because they weren't being consulted about it. It was not democratic at all. It was just being decided behind closed doors at the very top levels of labor officialdom. And so as these revelations came out, you know, the New York Times and Washington Post and other, like, establishment media was exposing, they were publishing these exposés about how unions like AFSCME and the Newspaper Guild, now the News Guild, the Retail Clerks International Union, and the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union were receiving money from the CIA, and they started talking about these different coups and things that AFIELD had been involved in Latin America. And rank and filers, to a large extent, were pretty shocked by this. Yes, there were also a lot of rank and filers who were supportive of the war. There was a notorious hard hat riot in New York in 1970 of construction workers violently attacking anti-war protesters, but there was also a lot of union opposition to the Vietnam War, especially among, like, Black and Latina healthcare workers in New York and elsewhere, Local 1199. And in any case, the focus on the war and the anti-war movement brought so much of this to light. And going into the early 1970s, you started to have rank-and-file committees calling for the AFL-CIO. And, oh, by the way, this is when the term AFL-CIA first started to appear. But rank-and-file committees calling for the AFL-CIO to break off all ties with the CIA, with the State Department, with USAID, to stop doing all of this stuff. And because of the U.S. defeat in Vietnam, you know, this led to this period of détente where there was more Cold War tensions, at least between the U.S. and Soviet Union and China, started to ease a little bit, even though the U.S. was still waging these really grotesque interventions in the global south, like in Chile in 1973. And because of this, you know, AFL-CIO leaders were getting frustrated. They were still to the right of the U.S. government. They were like, they hated George Meany hated détente. He was like, why are we negotiating? He hated the fact that Nixon went to China and met with Mao. At the same time, when Nixon started bombing Cambodia, George Meany was like giving him a thumbs up. Good for you. I'm glad you're doing that. Really wild. And this basically, Vietnam was kind of a blow to the Cold War and to anti-communism. The anti-communist forces in the U.S. started to regroup in the early 80s, you know, after Reagan was elected. And in particular, with running these types of interventions overseas, they looked for a new instrument to do it that wouldn't be associated with the CIA, because by that point the CIA had a negative reputation. And so what was created in the early 80s was the National Endowment for Democracy, the NED, which still exists. And the AFL-CIO played a big role in creating the NED. And the point of the NED was to overtly give U.S. funding to anti-communist organizations overseas to try to do these same kinds of, you know, interventions that the CIA had been covertly doing for many years. And so the NED was kind of like a new source of funding for the AFL-CIO to continue these types of activities to undermine leftists in labor movements in all over the global south and in Europe. So it became, you know, the idea is, you know, the National Endowment for Democracy, we're promoting democracy, we're promoting freedom, and it's a good thing. And, but it was really just the same old, only now being done out in the open instead of covertly. Although there was still a lot of covert stuff happening that wasn't being, like, you know, openly reported that the NED was doing.
Just to bring us all the way into the present, you said the NED still exists and some of these partnerships with the U.S. government abroad still exist. Could you just talk a little bit about what form that takes, you know, in the present day?
Yeah, there's the Solidarity Center. So, you know, even in the 80s, there was still continued pushback from the rank and file, and even from some union presidents, particularly when it came to the AFL-CIO leadership's support for Reagan's counterinsurgency program in Central America in places like, you know, Nicaragua and El Salvador. A lot of union people, union members, union presidents were saying, why are we partnering with Reagan on foreign policy when he's our, you know, our arch enemy here at home? And there was the creation of the National Labor Committee in support of democracy and human rights in El Salvador, a very long, that's the whole name of the organization, or just National Labor Committee for short, which was going against the AFL-CIO leadership and trying to say, calling for an end to all aid to the Contras, an end to aid to the military in El Salvador, and actually supporting leftist union unionists in Central America. And then there was, you know, with a lot of other developments in the early 90s, including NAFTA, and the, you know, a lot of the losses that the labor movement had been suffering throughout the 80s and early 90s, this led to the new voice movement in the AFL-CIO and new leadership coming in 1995. John Sweeney, president of the SEIU, became president of the AFL-CIO, and they said, we're going to shut down these anti-communist institutes like AFIELD. We're going to stop this horrible foreign policy. And so in 1997, AFIELD and these and similar, you know, institutes in Africa and Asia were shut down and consolidated, and instead in their place was the Solidarity Center was created as the AFL-CIO's new international arm. And the idea behind the Solidarity Center, as it was, you know, explained by the new AFL-CIO leadership, was like, we've turned a corner, we're not doing this anti-communist stuff anymore. We're just supporting workers abroad in their, you know, in their struggles for you know, better wages and better working conditions. But the Solidarity Center is still primarily, almost exclusively, funded by the U.S. government, by the NED, by the State Department, by USAID. You know, I haven't studied as much of what the Solidarity Center does, and it's only briefly comes up in the conclusion of the book because it's kind of outside the time period. I think Solidarity Center, you know, on the one hand, it appears to be doing a lot of, you know, decent, benign, you know, work in a lot of countries, but also there's evidence that, you know, like when Hugo Chavez became president of Venezuela, suddenly the Solidarity Center's budget in Venezuela went way up. Or when George Bush invaded Iraq in 2003, suddenly the Solidarity Center's Middle East budget went way up. So that it, sometimes it seems that the funding to the Solidarity Center seems to mirror whatever the U.S. foreign policy, you know, is doing at that particular time. So I think there needs to be more, you know, discussion and of what the Solidarity Center is and what it's doing and what kind of foreign policy do we want the labor movement to have. Do we want it to be dependent on funding from the State Department and NED and USAID, or do we want it to be more independent? You know, I have thoughts about that, but my point of this book is not to, like, give you those answers. It's to say, here's the history of what happened. Now you go decide, or you decide. I report, you decide. No, you discuss, debate, you know, have a conversation about this, because there is no conversation about it really in the labor. There started to be in the last 11 months because of the genocide in Gaza, but you know, there needs to be a lot more discussion and political education.
Great. I have one final question to bring us back to the beginning, and then we can open it up for Q&A. So you talked about how the AFL-CIO's decision to basically become an anti-communist organization first and a labor organization second was informed by this idea that class compromise would win for workers at home. If you can get a larger pie for America, you get a larger slice for workers by default. That completely breaks down throughout the 20th century, but especially with the advent of kind of neoliberal policies in the 70s and 80s, and to the point that, you know, basically once the Cold War wraps up and the usefulness of some of these structures to the U.S. foreign policy establishment, these are no longer structures that are necessary. the AFL-CIO finds itself kind of left holding the bag and unable to really influence policy in the realms that it would want to, which is to make workers' lives better at home. One lesson that some might be tempted to take from this is that the AFL-CIO and the US labor movement never should have intervened in matters over there, and that we should have stayed focused on bread and butter issues at home. That is a lesson that people are, you know, taking away from what's been happening in the past 11 months in Gaza, or some a talking point that we hear over and over again is focus on what's in front of you, don't intervene. And I don't think that's where your book is going. I don't think that's the lesson of the book. So I just wanted to kind of give you a chance to talk about what the lesson of your book is in your opinion, and what you would say to people who say, you know, that's what we learned from this history.
Yeah, I mean, the lesson is don't, for the labor movement, is don't participate in imperialism. It's pretty simple. And, you know, non-participation in imperialism does not mean you're just isolationist or you're just focused on, you know, what, you know, the so-called bread and butter issues here at home. You could still be internationalist. You could still have worker-to-worker solidarity around the world. That's vital. That's necessary, you know, and that's been recognized since at least, you know, the 1848, workers of the world unite, right, and the first international. So yes, internationalism is necessary and vital, but it's what kind of internationalism? Is it going to be just reflexively echoing and supporting everything the U.S. government does and the U.S. foreign policy priorities, or is it going to be challenging? And especially because, you know, we are, the U.S. labor movement exists in, you know, the belly of the beast, in the heart of the empire. We have a special responsibility, the labor movement here, to challenge, speak out and challenge and get in the way of U.S. foreign policy to the extent the U.S. foreign policy is imperialistic and militaristic. And that's not what the AFL-CIO's foreign policy, you know, traditionally looked like. It was always just supporting and bolstering U.S. empire. But yeah, you know, the, it's, you know, sort of ironic in a way. AFL-CIO was getting millions and millions of dollars from the U.S. government over all these decades to wage this Cold War crusade overseas, and partnering very closely with these high levels of the U.S. government on all these interventions and so on. But what did the labor movement get in return from the U.S. government? Did the government repeal the Taft-Hartley Act? Did the government pass any kind of labor law reform to make it easier to form unions? Did the U.S. government keep minimum wage going up, or did it rein in and regulate corporations? I mean, obviously the answer is no. Instead, the U.S. government just made it easier for industrial corporations to offshore, to, you know, send production overseas, and the fact that the more militant, class-conscious labor movements in many other countries had been decimated, in part with the AFL-CIO support, meant those, the working class of those countries were not able to resist, so it made it easier to do this sort of neoliberal globalization. You know, it was really, so even if you were just gonna, you know, forget morality and forget ethics and just look at self-interest, this foreign policy of the AFL-CIO made no sense. You know, you reap what you sow, I guess. But it's unfortunate because, this foreign policy was not democratic. It was not the rank and file having a say in it. Whenever the rank and file learned about what was going on, they, generally speaking, they would protest. They would form different committees and caucuses and, you know, to some extent made an impact here and there in certain places and times, like, you know, protesting against the Vietnam War, protesting against the counterinsurgency wars in Central America, supporting the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. You know, there's some positive examples that come up throughout the book, but unfortunately, most of it is, you know, pretty bleak. I don't want people to be depressed. That's not what I'm trying to do, but it's more just like laying out the, this is what happened. It's not pretty, but we can and must do better.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.